Let me first introduce the moderator for the next session, Rich Bendis, who's a very active and effective member of the committee selected by the presidents of the Academy to guide this project. We're very pleased to have him here. Rich?
Thank you, Chuck. And moderator's privilege, we had a committee meeting on Monday, and one of the major outcomes was that the DOE talked about the speed at which these sessions are coming to existence. And basically, I'm an outside the beltway guy, and I haven't really seen the quality and content of these types of conferences come together as quickly as they have. And I look at the role of the National Academy at this time as what I would classify an innovation intermediary. And why I say that is some of the indirect benefit we talked about on the committee is this dialogue that's happening with people within agencies. Mark Stanley's talking to the undersecretary from DOE in the back, talking about how to work together, and you've got Tom Peterson up here on the panel now. So if you have NSF, NIST, DOC, and DOE, and potentially DOD, now talking about all the PV programs, if you took the portfolio that Christina showed of the DOE programs and at the stage they were, and let's overlay NSF, let's overlay DOD, let's overlay all of the other agencies who are doing some work, where are the real gaps and how do we leverage resources more effectively with this federal technology investment portfolio that already exists, which hasn't really worked effectively ever in Washington, D.C. There are some individual programs working together, but we have never really had the integration and a national innovation strategy, and I think DOE is taking the lead to set the tone to get other agencies in cooperation, so I compliment them on doing that. We've got a very interesting panel here to talk about federal agency contributions, which was really, Alicia led that conversation with the last question to the panel. And our three panelists are Kent Rockford, and Kent is the acting director, chief technical representative for the NIST Boulder Laboratories and acting director of the Electronics and Electrical Engineering Laboratory. We have Tom Peterson, new to the Beltway, basically has been with NSF as the assistant director for the National Science Foundation's Directorate for Engineering. His profile is not in your material there. And he has just come from being the Arizona's Dean of Engineering and is a chemical engineer. And our third panelist is James Seitz. And James basically is from Colorado, as we've heard, Colorado State University, College of Natural Sciences, and was instrumental in the establishment of the university's clean energy supercluster. So we'll start with Kent from NIST, from Boulder, to kick it off.
Thank you very much. Talk briefly about NIST. NIST is one of the oldest federal laboratories, and we have a pretty unique mission. We're very broad, but we focus like a laser on measurement science. We also help develop standards, and I'll talk a little more about that. And we also promote technology. We're a fairly small lab in the scheme of DOE-type size laboratories. We're about 2,800 employees. Almost the same amount of associates. So those are postdoctoral researchers, those are guest researchers from companies, from other universities, from other national metrology institutes that can help us complete our mission. We also have about 400 of our staff working on a wide range, over 1,000 standards bodies to help set standards. We have several major programs. We have the Technology Innovation Program, Mark Stanley runs, who's here. We have the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Program, the Manufacturing Extension Program. We also have laboratory programs, and that's mostly what I'm going to focus on. Our laboratories are basically organized by discipline, so we have several laboratories that can bring measurement science assistance to bear to this photovoltaics problem. So I'm just going to start on the laboratory side. And why do measurements matter? This is an example of an intercomparison published about 3 years ago, hosted by NREL, where photovoltaic modules were sent around the world to some of the major laboratories to make measurements. And you'll see some interesting data. First, on the CIS system, we have a spread of almost 9% about the mean in terms of measurement capability. You also see some interesting patterns. The participant in the green block measured low on several occasions, but was also at the mean for single crystal silicon. the mean really, what does the mean mean? Well, here we've taken eight participants and then make an assumption that the mean is the right value. Well, that's not necessarily true. There's also an accuracy issue. This is the, you know, if you gave everyone a yardstick and asked them to measure 12 inches, the average is only going to be right if the yardsticks are correct, and we haven't made that certain yet. So one of NIST's role is basically to provide measurement traceability. So as the National Metrology Institute, our job is actually to be able to trace measurements to the International System of Units. And by providing that, we actually can underpin the comparison across companies, across nations, and across laboratories. And that's important because to facilitate trade, to have any kind of meaningful specification, companies, vendors, participants have to be able to agree on what a product is, which means the measurements have to be done well. And if you also want to do any efficient innovation, you have to be able to measure stuff throughout their R&D process so you can share results, so you can do reproducible engineering and production, even reproducible research to get an understanding of what you're trying to do. So at kind of a very base level, we do provide the traceability for a variety of optical quantities, optical power, et cetera, and electrical quantities that are used by a variety of participants in the photovoltaics community, specifically NREL, who does photovoltaic module measurements for a variety of vendors, gets traceability from NIST. And at a top level, we also ensure that all the units are traceable internationally by working with international partners, other national metrology institutes, through collaborations and treaties, through organizations that meet in Paris every couple years to make sure that internationally we're all on the same page. So we also do some more retail stuff in addition to this kind of a high level of metrology. In our building and fire research laboratory, for example, there are projects to try to do better measurements so we can better certify, better measure, better model net zero buildings, for example. Well, net zero building also requires some sort of energy source, so we've been improving some of the techniques to develop measurements. Recently, we have developed a new high-speed radiometer so we can get away radiometer to measure photovoltaic panels, so we can get away from the golden standard. In a lot of industries, the metrology often starts by having a golden sample, that this is the right one, and if you measure this, this is the answer, and that gets passed around. And that's kind of a bridge until you can actually get the measurement instrumentation to repeatably and reproducibly do that measurement without having some golden artifact. That laboratory is also building simulation tools and data in an effort to try to promote and better evaluate the energy usage in a building. There's a need to really verify the data and validate the data. Solar energy is just one aspect, but in that regime, they've actually done some simulations, gathered data in a variety of modalities or a variety of conditions and applications so we can get a better understanding of how to perform simulations so that we can do the economic analysis and the energy budget analysis of buildings. Now, this isn't just about photovoltaics, right? These systems also require a variety of electronics, and power conditioning systems is an area that NIST has been working in quite some time. This isn't your standard CMOS stuff. This is basically the semiconductor electronics that can convert the DC power from a solar panel into the AC that's used by the house, by the grid. And we've actually taken a leadership role in some of those measurements. We've developed measurement traceability to help that sector of the semiconductor industry develop more high-power power conditioning systems. And we're also leading some interagency groups. There's been a lot of talk about how agencies work together. This is an example where there is a group looking at high-power electronics that does have DOE, DOD, a variety of partners. NIST is, in fact, leading one of the pieces, the electronic working group. So we actually do have a broad program in semiconductor measurements that can lead into this, and I'll mention that in a minute. Service life is important because for these to make economic sense, obviously you have to be able to sell a product that has a fairly guaranteed lifetime so you can get your return on investment. NREL and other labs are doing this. This is not a trivial problem. There's actually a lot to this. NIST has built some devices where we can do accelerated aging at known humidity and temperature. But there's also another piece, and that's that to really understand the lifetime of something, you have to understand the processes that degrade it. Those are typically not the macroscopic panel size problems, right? Those are more microscopic, maybe even nanoscopic type measurements that need to do to really understand aging. That's another area that I think NIST can bring to bear. We have, as I've mentioned, a long-standing history in semiconductor electronics measurements, working with Semitech, working with SRC and others. And what we are finding is some of the tools we've developed to help that industry can be applied, can be leveraged towards this. One example recently, some researchers showed that the generated defects at the silicon dioxide interface are very similar in terms of the mechanism to the same failure modes we've been using for electrical stresses in MOSFETs. So we are in a position where while we have some programs that are definitely photovoltaic focused, but I think there's some opportunities for us to also take some existing knowledge within NIST to apply to this. In the future, as part of the President's budget submission, we're looking to leverage some of our current capability into more future-looking stuff, and this is in terms of later-generation photovoltaics. Dr. Eagleson made the point, and I want to amplify this, is there's actually a fair amount of work that is going on third-generation things that require are using inhomogeneities or nanostructures to increase efficiency. But clearly, to make those work, there's going to have to be some better understanding of some of these processes, carrier generation, carrier transport, electron hole band diagrams, at the very smallest levels, nanoscale type levels. But and this is an area we're intending to move into. But I think what's interesting is by gaining that measurement capability that can be applied to next generation work, I think it's also going to give us the tools that we can use to better understand reliability, defects, manufacturing in today's technologies as we try to advance up that curve, that learning curve of manufacturing. Now, everything I've mentioned so far is in the realm of what we call measurement standards and measurement science. We also do documentary standards. And in the United States, documentary standards are not handed down by the government. It's a collaborative process. And NIST's role is actually not to write the standards, but to send experts that have measurement expertise that also have a very neutral posture. We're unbiased. We don't have skin in the game in terms of trying to make a profit, so we can provide the participants with some unbiased and neutral and expert measurement information. So we're working in a couple ASTM committees that are explicitly working on photovoltaics, and in fact NIST Technology Services Laboratory is intending to start a mapping exercise this year to try to look at the documentary standards and try to understand what gaps exist and where work may be needed so we can identify the industry and better deploy NIST staff. As an aside, we also are doing a lot in smart grid. That's been mentioned a few times, and that's one where the documentary standards effort is just huge because we're trying to accelerate that. There's clearly a lot of standards that require input from the photovoltaic community, and that's going to be very important because the whole point of smart grid is to be able to use intermittent and renewable sources. In terms of collaborations, we actually have several. We're working a lot with DOE both on smart grid and some of these photovoltaic things in terms of measurements. We work with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, work with various standards groups and interagency groups, as I'd mentioned. So I think at NIST we do have a lot of measurement science to bring to bear, and we'd be very interested as the community comes up with any type of consortia or any type of better structure that if we could get an understanding, if you could tell us what your very, very hard, what we call NIST hard measurements, we'd like to take a look at those and we think we can help. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you briefly about NSF's role in photovoltaic research. As was mentioned, I'm a relatively recent joiner, I guess, of the National Science Foundation. I've been at the University of Arizona since 1977 in the Chemical Engineering Department, and most recently as Dean of Engineering. But what I'd like to talk about today really is three aspects of the NSF that I think is particularly important and relevant to this group. First, I want to just spend a little bit of time giving you an overview of some of the renewable energy research that's conducted primarily in our directorate, the engineering directorate, but also throughout the foundation. I'll focus then more specifically on some examples of photovoltaic research And again, that's conducted primarily in two directorates within the foundation, the Engineering Directorate and the Math and Physical Sciences Directorate. And then finally, I want to finish up by talking very specifically about translational research in engineering and how that supports renewable energy. And we've heard some referrals to these activities through the SBIR programs and others in previous conversations, so I think you'll find this hopefully useful for your particular interests. NSF, as you know, has quite a broad mission. We are not a, quote, mission-oriented agency, although our mission really is to primarily focus on support for basic research and education in science and engineering. Having said that, however, if you look at the portfolio of programs that we support, there's quite an extensive energy investment throughout the foundation. As you can see from this pie chart, most of it, as I said, occurs in two directorates, the Engineering Directorate and the Math and Physical Sciences Directorate. But in fact, you see support for energy activities throughout the NSF. So let me just give you a quick overview of some examples of renewable energy research that's supported. And again, this is primarily within the Engineering Directorate. And I want to start, first of all, by with an example of direct conversion of cellulosic materials to hydrocarbons or feedstocks for gasoline. This is a so-called green gasoline project, and it's being conducted at the UMass Amherst. This is not an alternative methodology for generating ethanol from corn or from cellulosics. This is actually a process that uses fast catalytic pyrolysis to generate directly hydrocarbon feedstocks from cellulose. We have a fairly extensive program that emphasizes a number of aspects of energy manufacturing and the need to address issues of systems engineering and in industrial engineering relative to scale up to large scale and low-cost production of alternative energy devices. We've got a program that supports energy extraction from the ocean that designs and develops a linear direct drive generator buoys. And this is actually a program that's done in collaboration with a small company through our so-called GOLI program, and I'll come back and talk a little bit about that in a second. There are a number of engineering research centers, and this is some of you may be familiar with the engineering research center concept. It's really, as far as the engineering director, one of the jewels in the crown. Large-scale operations involve multiple institutions. Almost all, virtually all, involve partnerships with industry. And there are four that I call out here that have an energy component to it. One at North Carolina State that focuses on so-called smart grid issues. A center at Iowa State on biorenewable chemicals. A smart lighting ERC headquartered at Rensselaer. And a center that focuses on compact and efficient fluid power at the University of Minnesota. And again, these are just the lead institutions, and there are a number of other universities and industries that are partners in all these. We also have a program that is outside of the sort of the disciplinary divisions called the EFRI program, Emerging Frontiers in Research and Innovation. And the objective of this program is to provide opportunities to support high-risk, potentially high-return research. And this is one of the few programs where we target areas for each solicitation. Most of the support, as I said before, comes through in the so-called unsolicited process where people can just propose their best ideas. But throughout the about four-year history of EFRI, we focused on a number of areas, and as you'll see, at least in the last 2 years, half of these areas have been energy-related, and this year, the solicitation both are focused specifically in energy. In 2008, we had a program in resilient and sustainable infrastructures. Last year, hydrocarbons from biomass, and the solicitation for this year, renewable energy storage, and engineering sustainable buildings. So all these are energy-related. Focusing specifically on photovoltaics research, and again, this is primarily in Eng and MPS. There's a Center for Powering the Planet at Caltech. Harry Gray is the head of that center. Some of you may have heard a presentation by Nate Lewis from Caltech on solar energy and the energy perspective as a whole. He's part of this center. And they're focusing on developing components for solar water splitting. Again, the idea there is to generate hydrogen that could be a potential use in fuel cells, and as you might imagine, we do a lot of research that focuses on fuel cells. This one at the University of Houston on nanoparticle catalysis for application in fuel cells. A lot of studies about the material properties of surfaces that are used for solar cells. This at UIUC, again, on materials characterization and specific new materials for solar cells. There's a MRSEC Center, Materials Research and Engineering Center at Colorado School of Mines, that has a broad range of interests in photovoltaic materials and fuel cell membranes. Some of the things that they look at vary from the very fundamental physics of electronic excitations and so forth to the more applied aspects of developing a more efficient photovoltaic cells. Optoelectronic processes and materials. This is a program that we support at the University of Central Florida. We're actually even supporting biomimetic self-assembly to try and develop more efficient anti-reflective coatings that can be used in solar cells. This work is at the University of Florida. And using nanostructured materials as an alternative to conventional lithography techniques for establishing lithography patterns on silicon substrates. And again, this has direct application to the design and development of photovoltaic devices. This is just a rough graph of what engineering has invested in photovoltaics. Obviously, if you compare this against the ensemble of DOE investment, it's a relatively small number, but it's I think it is growing. And in FY09, you only see basically what we've invested in the first three quarters of this year. So we expect it to be over $6 million this year. And one example of a project that we support through the SBIR program is this flexible solar cell array technology. And this is a company called Interphase Solar. And we've heard conversations about the flexible solar photovoltaics here already this morning. Now let me talk about more specifically the activities that we have within the foundation, and again, more specifically within engineering, that addresses this issue of translational research in engineering, and specifically translational research as applied to renewable energy. So what do we mean by translational research? I think everybody pretty much agrees that, as I said before, the primary focus of the National Science Foundation is to provide support for basic research in science and engineering. But that's not to say that we don't play a very important role in conducting research, particularly in engineering, that has a direct industrial and commercial application. And that really is what we refer to as translational research. It is almost always interdisciplinary in nature, therefore involves teams, not only teams within a university, but teams at multiple institutions and teams that involve industry and other government agencies. It relies on these partnerships heavily, and the expectation is that there's a deliverable, some clear benefit to society. And we think, obviously, in a rather perhaps biased way, that this pretty much defines the engineering space. So let me just talk about some of the programs that we have and then put these in context of basic versus more translational research. There are a number of centers throughout the foundation, the science and technology centers, the engineering research centers, and the materials research and engineering centers. There are specific programs that focus on industrial partnerships, such as the GOLI program, the SBIR programs, which we've talked about. I'm going to come back in a second and talk a little bit more about the industry university cooperative research centers. But there are also nanoscale science centers, the Emerging Frontiers program, as I mentioned, and other engineering programs. We've seen this chart in a number of different ways, whether you talk about Pasteur's Quadrant or the Valley of Death. There is this challenge of taking basic research in this discovery mode and translating it into commercialization. So where do all these programs that I just described at NSF fit on this? I think you'd agree that overall at NSF, most of the support is pretty much to the left-hand side of that graph at the discovery level. And even engineering, while it's a little bit more to the right, still is pretty much on the discovery side. But if you start looking now at these translational research activities, you find that we span quite a spectrum. The science and technology centers, which are foundation-wide, still focus primarily on discovery. But if you look at the industry university cooperative research centers, that may be the other end of the bookends here, which really have quite a bit of direct involvement with small business and industry. And the other programs that I mentioned would fall at various places along this spectrum. And even the ERCs, which started in 1985, probably at this particular location on this graph, have moved to the right in terms of their involvement in translational research. So this is the basic model of the Industry University Cooperative Research Center. NSF provides seed support for this program, but actually that support is more as a catalyst than anything else. It's a relatively small investment compared to the investment that comes from industry members, and the industry advisory committee for the IUCRCs is the critical component in this process. They may be single institutions or multiple institutions. They are more likely multiple institutions. And the model itself works almost like a research franchise. There's a very specific management model and structural model that has evaluation tools that are done in an independent way. And these are the sort of the hallmarks of the IUCRC program. Over the last 10 or 20 years, there have been a number of IUCRC programs, and as you can see, the centers have bounced around between about 40 and 50, and the number of sites as much as 100. And this just gives you an idea of where some of these IUCRCs are throughout the country. There are some universities that are involved in multiple IUCRCs, and as you can see, many of the states are represented. And as I said, the support that comes from the foundation, which is the very low light blue right along the axis, is a fairly small fraction of the total support that's provided to the IUCRCs. But what is equally important, not only in terms of the support, is not just the financial support, but the direction that industry gives to the overall research portfolio in these IUCRCs. So let me conclude by giving one specific example of an IUCRC that's directly applicable to this audience, and that's the Silicon Solar Consortium that's at North Carolina State University. It's a multi-university, multi-company consortium, as are all the IUCRCs, and addresses basic issues related to photovoltaic silicon materials and devices. And being an academic program, with industry interaction, the primary focus in terms of tech transfer is educating graduate students who can go to work in this industry. As I said, the primary lead institution is North Carolina State University, and George Rosgonia, who is here today, is the director. But they are partnered with Georgia Tech and Lehigh and Texas Tech. I've already mentioned this in terms of the partnership. It was established in 2008. And these are the types of areas that they focus on in terms of research areas. And as you can see, there are many aspects of issues related to photovoltaics that are important to this center. Just two quick examples of projects they're working on that relate to metrology and wafer breakage are illustrated here in terms of the mechanics and analysis of stresses and breakage, as well as using near IR transmission Unbelievable. Yeah. These are the industry partners that are participants in SISOC. As you can see, a combination of industries that are more traditional microelectronics industries, chemical industries, as well as those that are directly in the photovoltaics. There are about 15 members now, and with the expectation to grow to about 20 next year. So just to summarize, NSF has got a broad renewable energy portfolio, including photovoltaics. The engineering research portfolio includes an important element of translational research, and the IUCRC program is an important element of that. And SISOC is just one good example of the IUCRC program focusing specifically on photovoltaics. Last but not least, just some contact information here. First, with respect to me, and even though I am the director of engineering, I still would encourage you to contact me directly. And if you're interested in getting more information about SISOC, there's the website for that center as well. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm Jim Seitz, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm also pleased that at least a few of my university colleagues from around the country are also here, and if you have an opportunity, you can chat with them about the kinds of things they do. So what I want to do is, what I was asked to do was to give a university perspective on photovoltaic manufacturing. That, of course, is not a single thing, and so I'm going to give you a university perspective, and I think it's not too much different from what you would hear from a number of my university colleagues. The basic question, of course, is how can our research universities contribute most effectively to photovoltaic manufacturing, particularly in the United States? So I think it's important to realize that the success we've had to date in photovoltaic manufacturing has its roots in some university efforts, some of them going back a large number of years. And secondly, university researchers in general have a very high level of intellectual vitality, which I think is pretty helpful. We tend to be creative, well-versed in the literature. We're skeptical, which is something I think we all ought to note. And we also tend to be interactive by nature. So I think that universities clearly have a lot to contribute to future photovoltaic success in the U.S., and the responsibility, the collective responsibility of those of us in the room is to figure out how to do that most effectively. So I want to talk a little bit about foundational research, which is a little bit like user-inspired research we heard about before. But basically, foundational research is basic research, but it's directed towards specific problems. And this happens, of course, at universities, but not exclusively at universities. It happens all the time at the national laboratories and very much within individual industries themselves. There are a number of examples in the photovoltaic field, and I would be delighted to digress and talk about any one of these, but I was asked to not do that. And couple important points, though. One is that university foundational research often involves the development of fairly unique manufacturing and measurement facilities. And they exist throughout the country right now, and more will get developed over time. So I think one thing that in general we should do is take advantage of what exists at the universities as well as what exists at the national laboratories. Secondly, universities, by their nature, the student component, allows fairly labor-intensive exploration of problems, and particularly those which involve measurements over a very broad parameter set. This is sometimes a little difficult to do in industrial settings. There is a bit of an issue, however, and that is that much of our university funding these days comes through industrial subcontracts. Now, I don't have a particular problem with that. I have a lot of industrial colleagues, and we work well together. In fact, there's an industrial colleague making some measurements in my laboratory today. But if we swing the pendulum too much in this direction, we detract from the breadth and also the independence of the types of things we can do best at universities. There's another reason why we may want to take another look at this. And in fact, I'll go to my next slide, which has to do with students. Because highly skilled university graduates are the future of photovoltaic manufacturing. I mean, there's no way to overlook, neglect that, and so on. So one way or another, we want to encourage that to happen on a fairly large scale. PhD graduates in particular will be the likely source of a lot of creative ideas coming along in the future for our PV products. And keep in mind that PhD students, to do their job right, need a certain amount of stability in their research, which typically takes place over a period of 3 to 4 years. So the issue here is whether we can integrate graduate student training with individual company specific projects. And the answer is that often doesn't work so well. Sometimes it does. It depends a lot on the way the company looks at things. But we do want to preserve for our graduate students in training a fair amount of unrestricted dissemination of our results, and a thesis schedule that can be fairly smooth over those 3 to 4 years. We have to realize that a student in training may well be working for a competitor of a company which is funding research at that university. So So a couple suggestions, and one is fairly obvious from a university perspective, is that we should fund a fairly solid base of university PV research and its students directly. And that, of course, does not preclude the possibility, and in fact, synergy involved by also involving industrial subcontracts at universities. And another thing we probably should do on a larger basis is to expand the opportunities for research students at our universities to do part or all of their research training at one of our national laboratories. One of the things that university culture encourages is information exchange and collaboration. We've heard that mentioned several times already, the virtues of working together. There's kind of a practical reason in our case is because it's very rare that a single university has the resources, the expertise to work through a large problem internally. But it also kind of matches our philosophical outlook on things. The idea of getting together not only among ourselves but with national laboratories and industrial partners to cross-fertilize, synthesize new ideas, and bring this together, and the sum may well be greater than the sum. The sum may be greater than the parts. There are, in fact, and my the senator from my state mentioned this earlier, collaborative efforts going on regionally, and not just in Colorado, but in quite a few of the states represented here and otherwise. And also, there are networks of researchers from various universities tied in with laboratories and, in some cases, companies as well throughout the country. And the university contributions to that, I think, is something we ought to value and, again, figure out how to do it most effectively. So in the solicitation for funding, one thing which I think would be good, and I've heard others mention it already today, is that there's encouragement for these collaborative or consortium type ideas to come together. And I think also something we can do fairly effectively, and there's a clear example of it right here, is support topical workshops. This is a fairly broad topical workshop, but we can imagine those in different PV technologies, meeting on a fairly regular basis, because a lot of collaborations, which I know about, have evolved from people getting together and chatting about what they've been doing individually. Another thing which universities can bring to the table is leadership. At universities, we do a fair amount of strategic planning, often fairly effective strategic planning, and furthermore, we embody a fairly good source of expertise which can be brought to bear on national planning. So I don't think DOE wants to turn this over to the universities, but I think a role for the universities in this will get us a better product in the end. At the same time, on a more individual basis, faculty are pretty skilled at evaluation. I mean, we evaluate students all the time, we evaluate each other, we peer review and so on, and most of us do a fair amount of proposal review. And we tend to have that skepticism I mentioned before, and I think that's a very healthy thing to integrate into our proposal review. There is a bit of a problem in that most of us are also submitting proposals, and there's a potential conflict of interest between reviewing proposals and submitting proposals. And I think a consequence of this is that sometimes we have a scarcity of reviewers who are not don't have at least some potential conflict of interest. My feeling is we might want to lighten up on this a little bit. I know if the National Science Foundation, the project managers seem to calibrate their reviewers and manage this fairly well, same way with journal editors and so on. So I don't know if this should be a showstopper for bringing a broader spectrum of people into the review process. The terminology I use is to manage rather than to try to eliminate potential conflicts of interest. I want to talk about a few specific issues and then wrap up with a summary. So one issue I think we need to come to terms with is our relationship to other countries. And this has been mentioned several times today, but mainly in the context of commercialization. But I think also, and the fact that we have fallen behind a little bit in the U.S. in terms of the worldwide manufacture of photovoltaics over the last 20 years. But we've also fallen behind a little bit in terms of our foundational research. And this is particularly true within the European Union. So as we build ourselves in the U.S., one question we have is whether our international, the people we work with or don't work with, whether they're competitors, partners, and of course there are going to be some of both, and how do we most effectively come to terms with that. Another specific issue that I've seen, my perspective, is that at the moment we tend to invest in highly fundamental research with a pretty long-term horizon, and we also tend to invest in this industrially driven research, and in between there's what I've often referred to as a gap, and this is foundational research related to current technologies, and this is exactly, I think, where we need to spend a little more effort, a little more money, in fact, if we're going to advance our current PV technologies roughly in the 2015 timeframe. This term that comes up, the generations, first, second, and third, I think is somewhat it's overused, but is also a little misleading. First generation, of course, is basically silicon, high efficiency, reasonable cost. Second generation, the thin films, low cost, reasonable efficiency. Third generation is a little more vague, but generally speaking, third generation is either focused on very low cost or very high efficiency. I would be a little bit wary of when people try to morph that or into an and. But in any case, all of these generations need foundational research, and they also need critical review. And maybe the most important thing is that we should not assume some directionality here. In other words, the idea that the new generations will replace the old ones, which will die out. I would look at this more as a comprehensive whole, and there are possibilities in all three generations. Finally, a specific thing at universities is that we've been, in our opinion, burdened a bit with cost share requirements from some parts of Department of Energy, and typically 20%. And this has been a bit of a disincentive, I think, for some of the more creative faculty to work in the photovoltaic area. So I would hope that we would take another look at that and possibly back off a little bit. Summary of the strengths that I see at universities: for vitality and creativity, the talent pool, particularly for foundational research, source of graduates, maybe that's the most important one, the specialized equipment, and in many cases this is where we can directly work with industry, possibilities for planning, for incisive review, and in general, our ability to work on specific problems as well as the more general ones. And then the major suggestions I made is to restore independence to a larger fraction of funded work at universities in photovoltaics, to encourage student participation in most of our funded projects, facilitate not only multi-university but multi-institution collaborations, relax the restrictions on how we select reviewers, and possibly lighten up a bit on the cost share requirements. Thank you.